We'll move now to our seventh case of the morning. This is Appeal 25-1937, United States v. Nicky Houston. We're going to begin with oral argument on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Brown.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Attorney Sean Brown. I represent the appellate, Nicky Houston. Your Honor, Your Honors, we're asking that this case be vacated and remanded for resentencing because the district court failed to meaningfully address Ms. Houston's principal mitigation arguments at the time of sentencing. This isn't a challenge to the guidelines calculation. This is not a request for this court to change the sentence or to reweigh it. Essentially, what we're asking is that, or indicating is that the sentencing court, it acknowledged Ms. Houston's mitigation, but it never explained why imprisonment remained necessary despite those mitigation arguments. The core mitigation was urgent and it was concrete. Ms. Houston indicated that she had a minor son who had just been hospitalized for serious mental health issues. He had been released the day before sentencing and was returning immediately for partial inpatient treatment. Her request was for probation or house arrest, essentially, so that she could remain present during that crisis. With respect to the primary argument, that being that she posed during sentencing was about her son, defense counsel at the time told the court that Ms. Houston's adopted son had been hospitalized at Lurie Children's Hospital for mental health issues. He was released the day before sentencing and scheduled to return for partial inpatient evaluation and treatment. Counsel specifically requested a non-custodial sentence so that Ms. Houston would be able to tend to her son while still being responsible for the crime that she had pled guilty to and still submit to the court's sentence, ultimate sentence. Ms. Houston reinforced in her statement of allocution, she was asking for mercy, and she prayed that she would not have to leave her son. And the court acknowledged that statement of allocution. The district court made statements indicating that it was a good thing that she had decided to become a foster parent, that she was impressed by that. However, the court never meaningfully addressed why incarceration was necessary without going through the analysis of why she couldn't remain under some lesser condition so that she could tend to the needs of her family.
Isn't that effectively just an argument asking us to engage in different reweighing than the district court did? It's not the way you're saying it, Mr. Brown, but isn't that effectively what you're asking us for? Because I don't see how there's any chance at all that Judge Rowland, who acknowledged her awareness of the difficult situation with Ms. Houston's son and how admirable it was that she adopted the son and the circumstances around that, that she then entirely lost track of that when she imposed the sentence. I don't see how that's possible. And so when she says, I considered the argument, you know, I considered what you have presented, doesn't that specifically refer back to what they were talking about?
In context, it does, but the case law indicates that there has to be an explanation, not just an acknowledging the situation, but the district court has to explain why it decided to impose the condition of incarceration in light of the strong mitigation arguments that were presented during the sentencing hearing. Your Honors, essentially what happened when the court acknowledged the fact that Ms. Houston had this situation going on with her son but didn't meaningfully address it or conduct an analysis to, you know, to weigh whether incarceration still was necessary as opposed to a sentence of probation, the court essentially began to compare it with another case. The district court indicated that there was a co-defendant in this case. Essentially, this was a situation where a number of co-defendants were indicted for wire fraud. And the total amount of wire, of the total amount of money that was taken during the period concerning Ms. Houston was approximately $400,000. And there was a co-defendant who the total amount that she took was roughly about $280,000. So the district court indicated it wouldn't be fair to, it was co-defendant Sanderson who took $280,000 and she received a sentence of imprisonment. The district court said it wouldn't be fair to her if I gave you probation because essentially because you had taken more money than she did and she received a prison sentence. The second point that I raised in the brief is, and this wasn't the primary argument for defense counsel during the sentencing hearing, is the medical issue that Ms. Houston suffered from.
Is there a challenge there, though, because it wasn't included in her memorandum or not part of the PSR?
Well, it was a part of the PSR. It just wasn't argued during, well, it wasn't argued during the sentencing, and the probation department pointed it out during their investigation report that she suffered from neuropathy, she had frequent medical appointments, numerous arthritic conditions and ailments, and part of the 3553 factors indicates that when imposing a sentence, the court has to look at the medical care. So although that issue wasn't highlighted during sentencing, it was placed before the district court. And during the sentencing hearing, the medical care was completely absent in terms of an analysis being conducted to determine whether BOP could sufficiently tend to Ms. Houston's
medical. Wasn't that because her primary focus was on her son? You know, she, in other words, she was focused on caring for her son and how serving a custodial term of imprisonment could seriously impact that because he was struggling.
Exactly. And I think that's a great point, Justice Scudder. And part of the reason is probably why she forgot to mention all these numerous doctor's appointments that she had and these medical conditions is because she's had a serious and urgent issue that just occurred a day prior. And more likely than not, that's what she informed her trial counsel about, is focusing on that issue because that was primary in her mind. Like most mothers, you know, they tend to put their children and their issues first before their own issues.
I'd like to reserve the remainder of your time, Mr. Brown.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. We'll now hear argument on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Pavletic.
Thank you, Chief Judge Brennan. Good morning to the panel, and may it please the court. The district judge neither procedurally erred at sentencing by not meaningfully considering defendant's family circumstances or her medical issues, nor did it abuse its discretion in imposing a substantively unreasonable sentence due to a disparity with the co-defendant. Accordingly, the court should affirm the judgment. First, the district court did meaningfully consider defendant's family circumstances. The sentencing transcript reflects that the district judge explicitly discussed with defendant her son's challenges, and it clearly found them incredibly mitigating. But given the seriousness of the 6-year, $500,000 fraud, the court determined that the family circumstances were not so mitigating that a non-custodial sentence would be appropriate. Defendant may disagree with how the district court weighed these factors, but that does not require remand under Hodge and other cases from this court.
Maybe Mr. Brown wants to address this on remand, but we have absolutely said that if one of the principal arguments in mitigation is about family circumstances, that the district court needs to address that, and I think the district court absolutely did for the reasons you both kind of acknowledge here. But have we ever said that a district court has to go further and explain why a custodial sentence is either necessary or appropriate?
Not that I'm aware of, Judge. I think the standard here, as with other principal mitigation arguments, is meaningful consideration. And that is exactly what the district judge gave the defendant.
Yeah, I mean, the guideline range, the advisory range was 37 to 46, right? She got a year and a day.
Correct.
So something drove it down. And that something, I think, the way I read the transcript, is the really unfortunate circumstances with her son, which she focused on.
And that's how the government reads the transcript, Judge. I think Schroeder and its progeny only warned that a court cannot summarily dismiss or completely disregard a defendant's family circumstances argument. In other words, a judge may not simply brush it aside.
Yeah, and there's... Yeah, definitely. Go ahead.
No, that is just not what happened here. The court engaged the defendant on the issue and obviously reduced her sentence because of it.
And indeed expressed a lot of sympathy that seemed warranted.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Turning to the second issue, unlike her family circumstances, defendant's medical issues were not her principal argument in mitigation. Defendant never raised them in the district court, either by presenting them in her written sentencing memorandum or in her oral argument at the sentencing hearing. In fact, the record's only reference to defendant's medical issues is in the PSR and in the probation officer's confidential sentencing recommendation, which does not trigger the district court's duty to separately address the issues at sentencing. In her reply brief, defendant contends that a court must consider medical information in the record because it is a statutory obligation that does not hinge on counsel's arguments. But this theory runs headlong into the no checklist line of cases from this court that say that a court need not spell out its analysis of each factor, meaning that a court need not explicitly articulate and elaborate on its conclusions as to each factor under Section 3553A. Instead, it is adequate to briefly explain the factors considered most relevantly applicable without marching through and giving a speech on each one. Third and finally, defendant did not make an unwarranted disparities argument involving Harper or any other co-defendant in the district court. Nonetheless, the sentencing transcript shows that the district court did consider unwarranted disparities. It was just not yet able to compare defendant to Harper because Harper had not been sentenced and Harper's health was rapidly deteriorating, which ultimately warranted a disparity with defendant. In her reply brief, defendant asserts that the district court still needed to explain what she calls, quote, the Houston-Harper contrast. But again, significantly, this contrast did not exist at the time of Houston's sentencing because Harper was not sentenced until months later. At that time, there was no disparity for the district court to explain, and there was not enough information available about Harper for the district court to make a comparison to defendant.
And Harper was sentenced, but passed away prior to reporting. What's the sequence there?
Harper was ultimately sentenced to probation, Your Honor.
Okay.
She passed away during her probationary term while this appeal was pending.
Thank you.
Unless the panel has any other questions, the court should affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Pavletic. Mr. Brown, we'll move back to you now for rebuttal argument. I will note for the record, Mr. Brown, we did receive the redacted brief. Thank you very much.
Your Honors, the Justice Scudder, the argument you addressed concerning the district court's acknowledgement that is certainly the case. We're not indicating that the district court didn't acknowledge and didn't show sympathy to Ms. Houston. The issue is that there was no analysis conducted concerning why imprisonment was necessary in light of the family circumstances.
To your knowledge, have we ever said that a district court needs to be express on that point on the record? Because when I look at this, tell me I'm mistaken, The explanation for why there's not a sentence within the advisory range is because of everything. I'm just reading from the transcript right here. Everything that Judge Roland acknowledged, how impressive it was that your client adopted a child who was addicted to substances at birth and has helped him, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And she just kept talking about how it's such a loving act that your client engaged in. That's what explains the year and a day. I think going from 37 months on the low end down to 12 months plus one day. But have we ever said that's not enough? It's legally insufficient.
I haven't come across case law that would say that that's legally insufficient, but our position, Your Honor, is essentially relying on U.S. v. Cunningham, in which the court indicated that the district court has to explain why the mitigation does not warrant the requested sentence. And that's what the district court failed to do here. When essentially we were asking for probation, the district court pivoted and said, after acknowledging that, you know, the circumstances that Ms. Houston was going through, the district court pivoted and basically said, because co-defendant Sanderson received prison time and she took less money than you did, it wouldn't be fair to her, so I would have to impose a condition of prison time on you as well. And I believe the court reduced that sentence because co-defendant Sanderson was sentenced to 18 months. Your Honors, I'd ask that you remand the matter for resentencing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. Thank you, Mr. Pavletic. The case will be taken under advisement.